Blog Talk Radio.
The following broadcast is brought to you by the iGolf Sports Network.
Golf Talk Live is sponsored by the iGolf Sports Network and Golf Tips Magazine. Here's Andrew to tell you more about our sponsors.
iGolf Sports is a live stream broadcast and media production company providing quality programming designed to attract the golfing enthusiast. And Golf Tips, the game's most in-depth instruction magazine, including reviews on the latest equipment, tips from top teaching professionals, all designed to help you improve from tee to green. Welcome to Golf Talk Live with your host, Ted Odorico. Join Ted each week as he speaks with some of the best in golf. This week's special guest will join us a bit later. But first up is another great discussion on Coach's Corner. So let's introduce tonight's Coach's Corner panel.
All right, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, of course, Ted Odorico, and we've got a great show. I got another exciting episode of Golf Talk Live, Season 12. And this week on Coach's Corner, we've got John Decker and Pete Buchanan joining us. I'll tell you a little bit about each of them here in just a moment. And then a little bit later on the show, I'm really excited to have joining me this evening for the first time, Ryan Schneider. He's the PGA Director of Golf at Shangri-La Resort. That's, I believe, in Oklahoma. He'll be tonight's special guest, so I'm excited to have him. As always, we're live every Thursday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. Central here on the blogtalkradio.com network. And obviously, if you're listening to us, you found us. And for those of you that maybe tune in a little bit later on, or follow up after, the link for that is blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive. And for some reason, if you can't listen live, you can scroll down on that link and you'll come to the on-demand section and you can listen to all of the previously aired shows, including tonight after it gets uploaded at your convenience. And at the end of the show, during the outro, you'll be given some other great platforms that you can tune into the show as well. So thanks for sticking with us for all these years. I'm excited. I can't believe it's been 12 years since I've been doing this show, and I just love doing it. I'm going to keep doing it as long as I'm drawing breath and as long as the guys are willing to come on and share their valuable time with me. So let me introduce tonight's Coach's Corner panel, and we'll get into this evening's discussion. So first up is John Decker, and he is the Director of Instruction at the Medallion Club in Columbus, Ohio. Formerly, he was the head instructor at the Grand Cypress Academy of Golf in Orlando and the 2015 Southern Ohio Teacher of the Year. He is also a senior editor and top 25 instructor with Golf Tips magazine. His first book, Golf is My Life, Glorifying God Through the Game, which of course includes a Bible study. And he's also available for public speaking. So if you want to reach out to him, he'll give you the scoop, if you will, at the end of the segment, how you can best reach him for just such an occasion. Also joining on the program tonight on Coach's Corner is Pete Buchanan, and he's been teaching this great game for over 30 years. He's the founding director of instruction for Plain Simple Golf, which of course houses the Plain Simple Golf circuit and Simple Swing repeater training brace. And he's been helping golfers build a repeatable swing for all of these years. So guys, welcome to Coach's Corner.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you, Ted.
Good to be here.
All right, so what we're going to do tonight, something a little bit different. I'm very, really excited to talk about this, and I'm going to just give you a very short sort of synopsis here as we get ready. Over the last many, many moons, and I mean many moons, I have been working on, really, I like to call it a series of books. I'm not going to give you all the details, but one of the books we're going to talk a little bit about tonight, I'm going to extract a couple of chapters. We'll see if we can get to some of it or most of it. But if not, this is sort of a sneak peek. Now, the books are not available quite yet, but they will be in the next month or so. We'll start unrolling those. And I'm very, very proud of these. One we're going to talk about tonight is called Mastering the Green, A Comprehensive Guide to Golf. Filled with a lot of great nuggets in there. I think you're going to be very impressed once you receive it. It's going to be available, as I said, probably within the next month to 2 months. And then I actually have three others that will also be accompanying it, different topics, of course, all of golf, nonetheless, but very, very excited. So Over the last week or so, I've been sort of pulling from various chapters of the books some information that I think would be valuable to the listeners out there, and I'm going to have these guys talk about it. Now, they have obviously not read the book because it's not available. I'm just pulling it off of the draft copy, but these topics, I'm sure that they'll have no problem in answering. So this one, as I said, is this particular book that I'm talking about is called Mastering the Green, A Comprehensive Guide to Golf, and we're going to talk about beginning with chapter 4, and this is Mastering Putting and Chipping. Talk about advanced putting techniques. And one of the things that obviously is distance control. Mastering distance control is essential for successful putting. It involves the ability to consistently gauge the power needed to get the ball to the hole, regardless of the putt length. And to develop this skill, golfers must understand the dynamics of their putting stroke, beat of the greens that they're playing on, particularly that that day. So, John, I want to get you to talk about two things. Maybe just give a little bit of idea of how you try to relay the putting distance control to your students, and then how you help them to deal with things like breaks. And you can explain a little bit what we're talking about there. And this is sort of the beginning of chapter 4. So talk about distance control. How do we sort of get a handle on that? Maybe you can give an example, a drill or something that you use that you found to be successful. And then talk about dealing with breaks. What do we have to do? What are we looking at? And then how do we sort of handle that as well? So those are the two. And if you need me to repeat anything, just let me know along the way. But, John, I'm going to start with you.
Well, Ted, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. And, Pete, I really look forward to tonight's discussion, as always, with you. This is a great way to start, you know, when you're starting out in the season, is working on your distance control and putting. You're going to find if you're up here in the north where I am in Ohio, you know, you're coming off the winter season. You haven't played a lot of golf. You get out on the golf course, you get on the green, and then your distance control is off. And if your distance control is off in putting, you're going to three putt, you're going to four putt. Even the best players in the world, if their distance control gets off, that's when they three putt. It's typically the first putt doesn't get close enough to the hole. So one of the things that I like to do is from a drill standpoint, is I like to have all of my students kind of go out into the middle of the green, and I want to give them like a 30 to 50 foot putt where they're just putting to the fringe. They're not putting to a hole. So I don't want them to think about the hole. I want them to think about the distance they are from the center of the green to, say, the edge of the green where the fringe is. And then basically try to hit putts like that. And it's a great way to get a feel for the speed of the greens, because the speed of the greens is going to be in a direct correlation to your distance control. Obviously, if you're playing on slower greens, which in the springtime, a lot of times the greens are slower, you're going to have to make more swing. If you're playing on fast greens, like in mid to late summer, you're going to be making less swing. But you have to have the ability to adjust to the green speed so that you can get the distance control. One of the things that I do with my students is I focus on the time of their stroke, because if I can get their timing down to where they're going back into the ball in 1 second, so I don't want them to speed up on long putts and I don't want them to slow down their time on short putts. I want their time back into the ball to be a second. If I can get my students to do that, they will start figuring out the length of their swing based on the speed of their greens, based on the golf course they're playing at. They'll be able to figure out the length of their swing pretty fast. So I always, you know, once I look at their setup, as long as there's nothing, you know, really wrong with their setup or something like that, I'm pretty much going right into the timing of their stroke and trying to have them hit putts, you know, from 40 or 50 feet to get that speed down. It's a lot easier to get the speed down when you're practicing, if you're practicing long putts, than if you're practicing short putts. Because when you're on the golf course, the average tour player proximity to the hole is going to be about on a green that they hit in regulation, it's going to be about 30 feet, somewhere in that range. They're not always hitting the ball up there 4 or 5 feet from the hole if they're hitting the green in regulation. So the average golfer most likely is going to have a 20, 30, 40-foot putt whenever they get on the green. So learning to get that speed down for the longer putts allows you to hit the ball closer to the hole, and you don't have to stand over, you know, 5 and 6 and 7 foot putts, you know, comebackers or coming up short. You know, you're able to get the ball closer to the hole in one putt, and then that makes, you know, two putting much easier And in some cases, you'll actually make putts when you when you're focusing on the distance. As far as the break in the green goes, the best way to, you know, there's a lot of things we could talk about reading greens, but the main thing I always want my students to do is have a an overview of what the green is doing. Remember, the architect is building the green so that it will drain water. So they're always building a high point and they're always building a low point. Every green in America or in the world has a high point and a low point. So what you want to do at your golf course is you want to try to find the high point and the low point. And then based on where the hole is and your ball, you'll know whether you have an uphill putt or a downhill putt. So the first thing that you want to figure out is, are you putting uphill? Are you putting downhill? And then obviously the right to left or left to right, or sometimes you have a double breaking putt. So that comes, you know, those are things that you look at as well. But identifying those low areas and high areas will really help you when it comes to your green reading. And the last thing I'll say on this, there's three things on this. There's the, when it comes to reading greens, you have what we call the linear plane, which is the high point and the low point. That's the plane of the green. You have also, you have the crowns, which are the high areas. So think about the crown of your hat. That would be a high area. And then you have low areas. Those are saddles. Those are areas where the water collects and where the drainage, you know, everything kind of goes to the low areas. So when I look at a green, I always look, is the ball on the high area? Is it on a crown? Or is it on a low area? Or is it somewhere in between? And that'll help you as well when you're reading greens.
Great answer, John. Very, very in depth, and thank you for that. You know, Pete, there's so many things. I mean, we could literally go on and on and on. And I want to stick with putting, and a couple of points I want you to touch on. First and foremost is putting under pressure. This is a challenge that all golfers face, especially in competitive situations. And I think the key to success is to have a solid pre-putt routine that's going to help to instill confidence and ensure consistency in approach. So we're going to talk, get you to talk a little bit about putting under pressure. By all means, if you have any favorite putting drills that you like to incorporate in your teaching, certainly give it an example. And then just, again, based on your understanding of the short game, put together a team if you were working with a student. Obviously all students are different and everybody works a little bit differently, but if you were going to sort of generalize this, what would be some of the key factors you would want to have them incorporate in that sort of putting practice routine? As I said, first start with putting under pressure.
Well, again, Ted, thanks for having me on, and John, it's always a pleasure to be on with you. You know, putting under pressure, you know, you can go so many different ways with it, but I think the better you get at being comfortable on the greens, the less the pressure will get to you. I always try to get, a lot of times when we're practicing, we always have something to wager for when I have my students out on the green. It's something simple. It's, you know, so that there's an action for every putt, you know, so we're going to play for a nickel, or we're going to play for, you know, who's going to, you know, get the water afterwards, or what's going to happen. You know, whoever loses has to clean up the green and carry all the stuff in. You know, so we put a little bit of a consequence, per se, on just going around and making some putts to add a little bit of pressure there to get them comfortable, you know, under those situations. But I think when you're looking from an overall basis of putting, as John said, I mean, if you can really get your distance control down, it takes a ton of pressure off your putting, because you know you're going to roll that first putt up pretty close. And that's part of, you know, the routine that I set them in. I have, you know, a bunch of different things I have them do, from, you know, a clock drill where I have them stand in the middle of the green, and then they go around the green as far as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 o'clock, and they put a ball to the edge of the fringe from all of those different numbers. And then, you know, I'll have them do start line drills to where we get them to where they can start the ball. You know, we put a couple of tees about 2 feet in front of them, and they have to run them through there so they can get their start lines down, so they're comfortable with what they see and where they can start it. And then we'll do some drills to where we'll do a circle around where we'll put 3 feet from the hole, put five balls around them. Then we'll do five balls at 6 feet and five balls at 9 feet. And they have to walk around and putt all of those as they're going. you know, you just build a little bit on those to try to get them to see making a little bit different of a distance putt. But a lot of it is geared toward, you know, working on some distance. We do what I call a sound putting, to where I'll have them set up and close their eyes, and then I'll walk away, and then they have to putt to the sound of my voice. And so just to give them a different sensory of what they're trying to do, and, you know, farther, closer. And I try to keep the voice the same all the time, so not louder or softer, but just give them a different idea. And then also, you know, picking out a spot and then closing their eyes and putting to it. So they get a different sort of feel for how the stroke is. And then I have them, when they're putting, I have them walk their putts off all the time to figure out how far they are. So when you make a stroke, how far does it go? And obviously, based on the speed of the greens, that's going to alter depending on what you're doing. But if you have a basis for that, then you're always going to have a pretty good idea of, if I'm making these strokes, this is about how far it's going to roll. So as we have them putt through different segments, they'll putt the balls to the holes and they'll step them off to figure out how far that is. So when I make this stroke, it goes X. When I make this stroke, it goes X. So that way they're getting a little bit better feel for, you know, how much stroke they use, for what distance they see, and how they feel that distance to come into it. So there's several different things I do, you know, just to, from a basic putting standpoint, from, you know, distance control, start lines, and then just getting a feel around the green for different length of putts, and, you know, building some confidence in those. And like John said, you know, I like to do a lot of distance drills at times without a hole, just so they're not concentrating on, you know, what the hole is. I think in distance drills, you're just looking at trying to make the ball go a certain distance. You're not really worried about it going in a hole or not. And I can remember when I built a short game area for the Jacob Schools, and I was with them, our main putting green had no cups in it. We didn't put any in. Well, and that was what we used for distance control. So there were no holes in it. So they didn't have any, they couldn't catch their eye on trying to putt to a hole. There wasn't one, you know, because if you put a hole out there, they're going to turn, you know, they're going to somehow, somebody's going to putt at it. So we didn't put any of them on one green we used for distance control. And then we also use that for chipping distances too, because there's no pin. But yeah, there's a lot of things you can do, but I think from a pressure standpoint, I think from a mental side of that, you know, I always tease them when I say, you know, you walk up and you're on the 18th hole and say, if I miss this putt, I have to buy lunch for the fifth Saturday in a row. So you may as well just pick it up and buy lunch and save yourself the agony. You know, if you're talking to yourself like that, you're going to miss it. So, right. You know, you have to be positive in what you're doing and saying, you know, hey, I've had this putt so many times. I know the distance. I know the feel. I'm going to run it right in there. And so I think that can get them more comfortable. But also, too, the more time they spend on the green, the more comfortable they're going to get on it, you know. And so many people warm up at the range, drive right past the putting green, go off the first tee, and then they wonder why they don't putt very well. They don't spend any time practicing before they even go out. Yeah, definitely some things you can do to improve it.
Well said, Pete. Thank you for that. You know, there are so many other components to that, and I'm just going to mention a couple of things. We're not going to get into it because, again, it's, you know, for a more in-depth discussion. But, you know, one of the other things that players need to understand is, or golfers in general need to understand, is understanding green conditions, things like reading the speed of the green, adjusting to the slope of the green, or a couple of others that need to be considered in. And those are things that really you want to work with your professional on. And then just lastly, I want to point out too is, you know, we often see many golfers focusing on picking, you know, the right driver for them or the right irons for them, but they often neglect choosing the right putter. There's a lot of different putter types, everything from blade putters, mallet putters, and peripheral weighted putters. I'm not going to get into all the differences right now, but I talk about that in the book as well, just giving you just a general synopsis of what each type of putter are. And obviously, everybody's there are certain advantages and whatnot to the different styles. But again, it's up to the individual player. And then obviously, most importantly, I think you want to be, just as you would with your irons and even your driver, is you want to make sure that you're fitted correctly for your putter. You know, a lot of people just buy it off the rack and think, okay, it looks pretty good, and yeah, it feels pretty good, and they go with that, and that's fine. But sometimes the putters, if you're a tall player like me, if it's too short, you know, you're slouching over a lot and you're not really getting into a good putting posture. So you really want to make sure you take a look at that as well when you're getting ready to purchasing a new putter, as you want to consider a lot of different factors in. So I'm going to move, John, we're going to get into some things, and we're talking about advanced chipping techniques. And one of them is chipping with different clubs. And I want you to talk a little bit about that. You know, some people might have a favorite club, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm a firm believer. I think that you should be able to chip with a variety of different clubs. Maybe you could give, you know, a bit of a discussion on that, some of the advantages of maybe being able to chip successfully with more than just one club.
Well, chipping is one of my favorite things to teach. I learned from Phil Rogers. He was my mentor, and Phil learned from Paul Runyon, who was had a pretty good short game, won a couple of PGA championships. So, you know, the chipping method that I'm getting ready to explain is coming from two of the great short game players of all time through the years. And there's maybe a lot of listeners out there who don't know who these men are, but I would, you know, Google their names and you'll find out, you know, what kind of history they had in playing golf. One of the chipping method is basically you're putting with a lofted club. So you're using a 6-iron, 7, 8, 9, and pitching wedge. And it's based on simple ratios that are based on the loft of the club. Just like you would do if you're out playing and you're out on the golf course, you have a club that makes the ball go 100 yards. You have a club that makes the ball go 125 yards, 150 yards. You just simply change your club. You don't change your swing. You change your club. Well, in the chipping method I'm going to explain, you're doing the same thing, but you're using different clubs around the green. So a 6-iron is a 1-to-6 ratio. So the ball lands on the green. If it's in the air for 3 yards and lands on the green from, you know, you're right off the edge of the green, then it's going to roll 18 yards. The 7 is a 1-to-5 ratio. The 8 is a 1-to-4 ratio. The 9 is a 1-to-3 ratio, and the pitching wedge is a 1-to-2 ratio. And so it's just a simple way of turning a lofted club into a putter. You're going to stand very close to the ball. The ball is going to be played middle to back of the stance. You're going to take a normal width stance. You know, your feet are going to be comfortably, I'd say, maybe 6 to 8 inches apart, and then you're going to lean your weight forward toward the target, and then you basically make a putting motion. I actually use my putting grip when I do this. Because the club is longer, my 6-iron is much longer than my putter. I have to stand, and I'm standing closer to the ball, I'll choke down on the club a little bit so that I'm a little bit more comfortable. And it's important, you know, the way Phil would teach us to do it when we're working with our students is to let the heel come off the ground and just basically put the toe of the club on the ground. So you don't put the entire club on the ground. So you're standing close to the ball, the heel's off the ground, and then you make a putting motion. And what you'll find is when you look at these ratios, when the ball's in the air and then how far it rolls, you're able to groove in a swing. So you're not having to change your swing. And I've had this discussion with a lot of teachers who said, John, you know, that's too complicated. The average golfer, you know, would be better to just use one club. Well, if you're using one club, then you have to change your swing every single time that you have a different chip shot. If you have a short shot, you have to change your swing. If you have a long shot, you have to change your swing. With the system that Phil introduced to me, you never change your swing. And it's a lot easier to change a golf club than it is to change a golf swing. So unless you have, you know, hours and hours a day that you can practice and work on short, medium, and long chip shots, then that's something you'll be better off to go to a system where that I just mentioned. And the other thing that I see, you know, it drives me crazy when I work with a lot of the high school and even some of my collegiate players, is they want to carry the ball. They're too much in love with their lob wedge. They want to carry the ball. They want to spin the ball. I don't want my ball to spin when I'm around the green. I want my ball to hit on the green and roll like a putt. So I always say to them, okay, you think it's easier to hit the ball in the air to the hole? I'm going to take you and put you 40 feet from the hole on the green, and I'll give you two clubs. I'll give you a lob wedge, and I'll give you a putter. Which is going to be easier to get the ball to the hole with? And they all look at me and they say, well, the putter. And I say, that's because you're rolling the ball on the ground. You're not hitting the ball in the air. Once that ball gets into the air, you lose control of it. You're going to have all kind of different funny things that happen. Plus, when you're under pressure, it doesn't hold up as well as a shot that's lower to the ground and letting the ball do the work versus the student doing the work. So chipping in a lot of ways is a lost art. I don't see a lot of teachers out there when I'm watching videos or seeing stuff on, you know, on the internet. Everyone wants to talk about the full swing and the flop shot and stuff like that. Chipping to me has kind of been a lost art. In my opinion, it's the simplest way when you're just off the green to get the ball on the green and let the ball do the work.
Excellent points. And, you know, let me just add real quickly, you know, for those of you that have been around for, you know, as long as the three of us have, we all remember the famous video that Jack Nicklaus did, Golf My Way. And he talked about the very same thing about using the same swing, but just changing the club. And the reason he did that was for the very reason you pointed out, is he didn't want to have different types of swing. Obviously, the length of the swing changed depending on the shot he had, but essentially the swing was the same. And all he did was just change the club for the appropriate circumstance. And he did that because it was easier to learn one golf swing and just use 14 different clubs than to have 14 different clubs and 14 different swings. So well said, and some great points. And I like the system that you identified because I think it is a better way. And the circumstances are always going to be different. Pete, you know, one of the other things that has to be considered, and we're going to talk, I mean, there's so many things in this book. One of the things that I tried to do, or and I think I've done very successfully, and once it comes out and people see it, I think they're going to really understand just the length and the level of depth that I went into the game itself. And yet it's very, very short and concise in each category. I didn't get real lengthy in all the descriptions. I just basically gave you a general overview, but it covers a lot of topics that a lot of people have understanding or misunderstanding in some cases. So I wanted to set that straight. One of the other things when it comes to chipping, Pete, is understanding lie conditions for chipping. As an example, chipping from the rough or chipping from tight lies. Touch on those a little bit because they're obviously different. You're not always going to get a perfect lie. You might be in the rough. So there might be some things that you want to consider here, as well as if you're on a tight lie, there's things that factors that might need to be considered there as well. Maybe you could touch on both of those a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good one. You know, it's, and I like what John said, it's a lost art because, you know, when I was a kid growing up, you know, a lot of times we couldn't play because we had certain hours that the juniors could play on the course. We were always around the green. And so, you know, that was a game changer for us because we could pretty much get up and down from anything because we practiced it all the time. So yeah, it really is a lost art, but you know, when you're looking at the different conditions, the tighter it is to the ground, I know some people like to panic a bit, but you just got to make sure that, you know, as the lie gets tight, you know, it goes back to when a lot of them like to use a very, very lofty club on some of those shots. And now you got a bounce to deal with on a tight lie. It's going to bounce off the ground. You'll probably end up, you know, blading it across the green. So you're better off with this style of chipping method, but just making sure that you've got, you know, the ball behind center and you got a little bit of weight lean forward and you want to maintain that forward so you can make sure you can get to the back of the ball with it sitting on that tight lie. And it'll probably, you know, you may not get it in the air as much on some of the other ones that you would, so it may roll a little bit more. So if the lie is very tight, so you have to take that under consideration. But if you practice it, you'll notice that. Because you're not going to get as far down on the ball with it really, really tight to the ground. But it's an easy one to be able to deal with as long as you know, set up with a situation where you can get to it and, you know, making sure that the ball's positioned so you can collect the ball first. And when you get in the rough, it really depends on where the ball's sitting in the rough. Is it on top? Is it in the middle? Is it down the bottom? I've always liked to say, you know, the more down in the rough it goes, the more loft you need to get out of it. You know, so sometimes when you're chipping around the green, you know, you may have to adapt if the ball's sitting way down there, a little bit of the swing and a little bit of the imagination, because you're going to need a little bit more pitch to get down there to get the ball out of there. So you might need to, you know, go down to a wedge. Sometimes you can use a sand wedge to chip with as long as you make sure you're watching the bounce. And I think sometimes it's actually an easier one if you open a wedge up like that, because it'll slide through that deep grass a little bit easier. And if it's in the middle, you know, you have to watch where you're placing the club when you set it down versus in the middle versus sitting on top of the rough. You know, if it's on top of it, you know, you have to make sure that you're not going to make a swing and go underneath and just drop it down in a nice little divot you just made under the ball. You know, you want to address it where the ball sits to give yourself a little bit of an easier time to collect it. And I've found, for me, when the ball's sitting up, if I get the ball even a little bit further back in my stance, I can catch it a little bit more solid if I just set the club up where the ball's sitting. And when the ones are in the middle, you know, you don't need as much loft if it's you know, nestled just a little bit down into the rough. But I will find that, you know, anytime you catch a little bit of grass between the club face and the ball, you know, you're going to lose some of that little bit of stickiness that it might have, and it's going to run a little bit. So you just have to take that into consideration. But that technique is really similar to the other chipping technique that you would use. But again, you have to look at, you know, the depth of the rough that you're in, the type of grass that you're in, you know, making sure that you have enough swing to get through that type of grass. I would always tend to set the face a little bit more open when I'm in the rough around the green versus closed, because closed, the leading edge can catch and it can dig a little bit and snag a little bit of the grass. I've always found that if it's a little bit more open, it slides through the grass a little bit easier. And if it's open, you have more pitch to get the ball up in the air. So those types of shots around the green and the rough take a little bit of, you know, understanding where your ball sits, the type of swing you're going to use. And, you know, you need to practice those, because, you know, a lot of these greens, you know, when we're playing, you know, we tend to miss them, you know, when we're playing, you know, pretty close to the green. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, the amateurs are getting situations around the green they haven't been in very much because they haven't practiced them very much. And, you know, it's just a matter of seeing the type of rough, type of grass that you're in, understanding where the ball sits, the more down, the more loft, you know, and then using a technique to get yourself to where you're comfortable, you know, advancing the ball out of those different types of grasses around the green. I think the tight one's a little bit easier than, you know, the different depths of rough, because you have to, you know, determine what you're going to do based on, you know, how far the hole is away from where you are and you know, getting the club through that type of grass. But, you know, a little bit of practice will never hurt in getting those situations and working yourself through it.
Some great points as well, Pete. Thank you for that. And again, it really boils down to this, you know, all of the things that we talk about here on Coach's Corner. It's great to have that information. It's great to get that, but you have to put it into practice. You have to get out there and you have to work on it. That, you know, if you want to become a better player, it's great to get all this information. You can absorb as much as you want, but if you don't actually put it into practice, you know, a very good example of that is if you look at most, nowadays the tour players are pretty much playing all year round, so they don't really get a lot of downtime. So they're always constantly working on their game. But I can remember, you know, when, you know, they would sort of end things in October and, you know, have November, December, and maybe think about coming back out in January or February on the PGA and obviously LPGA as well. But so they would have a couple of months off unless they were playing special events. So for a lot of these players, they'd get a little rusty if they weren't, you know, they'd have to come back out and work on certain things. Well, that applies even more so for amateur golfers who maybe you're only playing once a week, one round a week or once every couple of weeks. You know, you got to get out and you got to practice because you get rusty, especially with the short game. Long game, it's a little bit different. You can kind of fudge your way around a bit, but with the short game, you start to lose a little bit of that feel. All right, we're going to move on. This is, again, excerpts out of a book that I've put together that I'm going to be releasing shortly. It's called Mastering the Green, A Comprehensive Guide to Golf. And we're going to move into Chapter 5. There are many other things talk about wedge play and that I'll leave for the readers when the book is available. But I wanted to touch on a few things. We're going to talk about golf course management and strategy. But first, I just want to mention a couple things. And then, John, I've got something specific for you to dial in on. One of the things I think is important in this area is understanding golf course layout, types of golf course you might be faced with. There's a lot of different designs, each offering unique challenges and requiring different strategies. So the three main types of golf courses are, of course, your links course, which you see a lot over in Europe, parkland, which would be here many courses, some of your older style courses like Pinehurst and that. And then, of course, desert courses, which you'd see out in Arizona you know, areas like that. So I'm not going to get into the specifics, the differences in that, but there's different types of courses and some of the key features of courses I talk about here as well. Just giving you sort of the importance of the features, including the layout of the holes, the placement of hazards like bunkers, that sort of thing. And so you know, each hole is sort of designed with a specific challenge in mind. And I think having a better understanding how the course you're playing, if you're a member of a course, if you've been there for any length of time, you kind of know the lay of the land and you might know a lot of these things. But one thing we could always use, and John, this is where I'm going to come to you now, is I'm a firm believer in strategic tee shot planning. Especially you're getting up to that first tee, I think it's important that you make the right choice of club. And that's what I want you to talk about, is choosing the right club. Because the tee shot sort of sets the tone, not just on the first hole, but every hole. Talk about that, choosing the right club. And if you got enough time and you want to add in there, maybe talk a little bit about aiming and or even shot shape for more advanced players.
Well, you're exactly right, Ted. It all starts with the tee shot. The tee shot is the most important shot in golf, and statistics will back that up, because if you can't get the ball in play, I don't care how good a putter you are, I don't care how good a chipper you are, if you're hitting the ball out of bounds or topping it or popping it up, it's going to take you so many strokes to get to the green that at that point in some ways it feels like it doesn't matter. So, you know, what you want to be able to do is, number one, especially if you're playing tournament golf, is you want to have a club that you know that you can get in the fairway. I know that a lot of the courses I play at the senior level now. And so, I don't have to hit 300-yard drives at the tees I'm playing. So a lot of times I'll use a 3-wood or a hybrid off the first hole, especially if I'm nervous, unless it's an extremely long hole or a par 5. I'm going to go with one of those clubs usually because it's a good way to kind of get my round started. You also would like to have a go-to shot, you know, if you like to play a draw or if you like to play a fade. I try to have all my students use the tee box. I don't want them to just tee up in the middle of the tee box. So if you're a drawer, if you tend to play a draw, which is a right-to-left shot for a right-handed player, you're going to tee up more on the left-hand side of the tee box. That's going to give you more room to shape your shot. That's going to make the fairway wider. If you're a drawer and you tee up on the right-hand side of the tee box, you've essentially made the fairway more narrow by doing that. If you're a fader or even a slicer, you want to tee up on the right-hand side of the tee box. So I get a lot of students who are slicers or have a big fade, and you know, we're out on the, you know, maybe I get paired with them in some sort of event where I haven't been able to work with them, you know, on the driving range. A lot of times when I'm going and doing, you know, corporate stuff, and I get paired with somebody and I don't get to work with them on the range, and they have a big slice, I tell them, every time you tee up, you need to be on the right-hand side of the tee box. That will make that fairway as wide as possible for you. Now, obviously, we want to fix the slice, and that's something you do on the lesson tee. But when you're playing on the golf course, you know, you kind of want to go with the shot that you have. So those are important things as far as, you know, where to tee up. Obviously, you're going to have a target. You want to have a pre-shot routine that's based around your target. Everything's based around your target. I had a lesson today with the gentleman, and we were I was assuming that he was, based on where he was setting up, that he was hitting over the yellow flag, which was right in front of us. And after about 5 minutes, I said, "What's your target?" And he said, "I don't have one." And I said, "We have a problem here, because I'm assuming you're basing these shots on this yellow flag, and you're telling me that you don't have any target." So picking a target is the first thing that you do with your pre-shot routine. And then, you know, from there, based on where you're teeing up on the tee box, you've got your ball position, distance from the ball, all those things are important. But you never want to forget about that target. So when you're making your practice swings, and you should always make at least one or two practice swings when you're hitting a driver, I like to make, just to keep yourself loose. But when you're doing it, make sure that you're turning and facing the target. So from a course management standpoint, those are important things that you can do. You know, having a good pre-shot routine, picking the correct side of the tee box to tee up on, those are important things that will help put the odds in your favor, make the fairway as wide as possible, and give you the best opportunity to get the ball in play.
Again, well said. You know, that tee shot is, again, something that gets overlooked a lot. People, I think, especially on the first tee, you know, they're nervous. They don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to look bad. And they don't really go through a good pre-shot routine. They just sort of get up there and hope for the best. And and figure, well, I'll wait till I get to hole number two. So they're not really planning any sort of strategy in hole one. They're just trying to get past the crowd, if you will, around the first tee and get out there. So I think it's very, very important to, and I like what you said too, and I think this is, again, so important. You know, don't tinker or try to fix an issue that you may have. So again, if you're a slicer or hitting big fades, don't try to work on that when you're out playing the round. That's, as you pointed out, for the lesson tee. That's something to work with your teacher professional, your coach at a later point when it's the right time to do it. Just play with what you've got. So I like the fact that you brought that to the attention as well to the listeners. Pete, approach shot strategy is another one. You know, we've hit a good tee shot. Couple things to consider. You know, now we're maybe in a position we want to go for the green. We have to factor in distance control, and obviously there are a few different things that you can touch on here. And when aiming for the greens is another point that I'd like you to touch on. Aiming for the green involves much more than just, firing at the pin. So touch on those two areas, distance control, how do we sort of put that into play, and then also talk a little bit about when we're going for the green, some factors we might want to consider.
That's another good one. You know, distance control, if you don't have it to begin with, then it makes it a little bit harder. You know, you have to have a pretty good idea of how far each one of your clubs are going to go. Particularly, and I'm sure John, both of you guys have run into this, you know, amateurs are usually more short than they ever are long. So they usually don't take enough clubs. So make sure you have enough clubs, you know, for the distance that you're actually going to hit it. And understanding that the depth of the green could be 30, 40, 50 yards. And, you know, look how many club lengths are in between, you know, those distances from the front to the back of the green. So make sure that from a, you know, not only a distance control, but a club selection point, you've got enough club for what you're looking at. And then once you know what club you're going to use, you have to look up at the green and see what you're up against. Is the green pitched a particular way? Is there trouble on one side or the other? If you're somebody who tends to fade the ball all the time and there's trouble on the right, well, you might want to consider that in what you're trying to aim, where you're trying to move the ball to. You know, try to play your shot to keep you away from the trouble that exists up there. Is the green, you know, sloped from front to back? Are there bunkers up there? Water on one side or the other? You know, you have to look at the indicators around the green for, you know, if you're going to hit a shot. You want to leave the ball in a place that's going to give you the best chance on the next stroke. So you want to try, for a better sense of the word, just avoid the disaster and avoid the trouble that's up there. I know for me, you know, I get this question quite a lot because I play the ball fairly straight, and they'll tell me all the time, so, well, if the pin's on the left, are you going to shoot at the pin? And I said, well, if there's no trouble over there, yes. But if there's trouble over there, I'm going to shoot to the middle. Because I'm going to steer myself away from the trouble. So sometimes, you know, playing to the center of the green is also a pretty good deal as well. You can avoid both sides if you hit it in the middle of any trouble that's out there. I think when you're looking at trying to aim towards the green, you know, picture the shot you want to hit based on that shot that you see, what's up there, and based on that shot shape, what kind of trouble could you get in based on the way the ball is going to go. So if there's trouble right or left, depending on which way you're playing it, aim the opposite to help you avoid that. And I think that will give you a much cleaner chance to get the ball onto the green. And you know, I like one of the things I heard a long, long time ago that, and they told me Sam Snead said it, and I'll just repeat it, but he said, if you hit it in the center of the green, they can't hide the pin from you. And so that's always been a pretty cool thing to do for most amateurs, you know, just hit it in the middle of the green and then play from there until you can get proficient enough with your distance control and the shot shapes that you do, and then to start working it towards the other side. You know, get the right distance of club, get it to the center of the green, figure out how to hit the middle of the green first, and then you can start, you know, as you're getting better at that, working the ball to one side or the other, depending on, you know, what trouble there is, what the green looks like, uphill, downhill, and those types of things from what you're going to face when you play.
Yeah, right on the mark, Pete, again. You know, I'm a firm believer in that as well. You know, when I've worked with my corporate clients over the years, especially those that weren't as skilled, you know, I said hit for, you know, the center of the green, or certainly at the very least the fattest part of the green where you've got lots of room to work with. yeah, you might not be as close to the pin, but you know you're safe and you're on the dance floor, as they say, and it's a lot easier to work with your putter than it is trying to hit some specialty shot off of the green or over a bunker. So always, hit for the center of the green and hopefully, maybe it will, depending on the slope of the green, maybe it might even roll closer to the pin, depending on where the pin is located. So, but that's some great advice, and I think a lot of amateurs would find their games would improve greatly if they wouldn't try to pull off shots that they really not have the skill to do. John, there's a lot of different points I'm going to throw in here. Certainly, I don't want you to go over every one of them, but I'm just trying to cover the bases here. So you're welcome to extrapolate what you feel appropriate. First one is dealing with golf course hazards, things like water hazards, bunkers, sand traps, out of bounds or penalty areas. You're welcome to dial in on any one of those as an example. And then weather and course conditions, things like playing in the wind or playing in wet conditions, or maybe even adjusting if the course is particularly firm that day. So you're welcome to pull any one or two of the points, one out of each category if you want, weather and course conditions, and also dealing with some of the hazards that one may be faced with out in the golf course, because that all falls under how you manage and strategize your particular round. So whatever you feel appropriate, and if you need me to repeat anything, just let me know.
Well, when I, going back to the strategy of playing a hole, the first thing that I look at when I look at any hole is where the trouble is. And when you're talking about the penalty areas, it all starts with out of bounds. Out of bounds is the worst penalty in golf other than being disqualified, because there's no options. You have to replay. You have to take a penalty. You hit your shot. You have to take a penalty shot, and then you have to start all over, so you've gained no ground on the hole itself. So that is the most severe. The second most severe is going to be the yellow penalty areas, because you have a little bit less options, and then the red penalty areas. So yellow and red are very comparable. So if you put me on a hole and the left side of the fairway is white stakes and the right side of the fairway, which it would be red stakes, then I have to, I have to kind of pick my poison as far as bailing out, erring one side or the other. I'm probably going to tee it up more on the right-hand side of the tee box because I would tee it up on the left-hand side of the tee box because the most difficult or the most severe penalty is on the left side. So by teeing it up on the left-hand side of the tee box, I'm going to be hitting away from the out-of-bounds, markers. So in that severe of a hole, I would pick, teeing it up on the side where the trouble is. I always tell my students, see where the trouble is and then tee it up on that side so that you're hitting away from the trouble. If there's trouble on both sides, you need to know your ball flight. So if you play a draw, you tee up on the left-hand side. If you play a fade, you tee up on the right-hand side. Now, course conditions, this is where, you can have the whole round can change on you. If you watch the Masters, you saw what's going on Friday. I mean, I've never seen so much wind at Augusta with the sand blowing out of the bunkers. Yesterday here in Ohio, we had hail and big rain. So you get all kind of weather out there. But basically, when you're out there on the driving range, I try to figure out when I'm warming up. That's when I'm really trying to pay attention to the course conditions. If you're teeing off in the morning and it's cooler, the ball's not going to carry as far. So if you normally hit your 7-iron 150 yards and you get on the first hole and you're 150 yards away, you may want to consider going to the 6-iron because you're going to be losing distance. And the other thing you have to pay attention to is the weather conditions change. They could improve as you go through the day. So it could get warmer. So maybe by the end of the round, by the time you get to the back nine, your ball is flying those distances. So don't say, well, in the first hole I hit a 6-iron, it was the right club, and on the 18th hole I was 150 yards, I went over the green. You have to make those adjustments based on the weather. And then wind is probably, the most difficult thing to play in, because when you're playing in high winds, as soon as you hit that ball, you're at the mercy of the wind. And the wind can change while the ball's in the air. It can go from not blowing to blowing, or from blowing too much to dying as you hit your shot. So that's something that you have to have experience in when you're playing. And what great players are able to do is they accept the fact that they cannot control the weather. They cannot control the conditions. So I had a kid I was working with this week, and he was complaining about playing in cold weather. And I was like, you can't do that. You can't complain about the conditions. You can't control it. So it's important that when you're playing, is if you're playing in conditions that are less than ideal, is that you really pay attention to the bailout areas, and that and you have a more conservative game plan, and you rely more on your short game on days like that, and you try to chip and putt your way to hopefully, you know, a good score, because everyone is pretty much playing under the same conditions, and if it's cold, you know, for you, it's cold for everyone else. So you just need to understand that, you know, sometimes it's not going to be ideal, and you just have to kind of suck it up and just say, you know what, I'm going to rely on my short game today because it's not ideal weather. I'm maybe not going to hit the ball as far. I'm not going to hit as many greens, so I'm going to need that short game. So those are some ways to help you around the golf course when the conditions are not ideal.
Yeah, and, you know, you're exactly right. What a great conversation to have with the student, you know, is you're not going to be able to control the elements. You know, all you can control is how you adapt and handle situations. That's really about the only thing you control. Other than that, it's out of your control. So you might as well, as you say, suck it up and deal with it. Pete, I think you would probably agree to that as well. We often hear, especially with some of our younger golfers, you know, get caught up in wanting to, you know, as it was pointed out earlier, you know, they get all jazzed up about hitting those high flop shots and that because they see the pros doing it, but they don't factor in that there's other more effective shots around the green that are going to help them score better. So, you know, it's great to get, you know, to fantasize about hitting the hero shot, but those tend to be farther and fewer between. This last area I'm going to get you to touch on as we get close to wrapping up the Coach's Corner segment, and that is the mental aspects of course management, decision-making on the course, and also managing emotions and stress. Touch on those two key factors, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, those two are really good. You know, first of all, you have to play shots that you know you can play. You know, from a mental standpoint, you know, you just mentioned it a time ago, you know, anytime you say to yourself, I saw this shot on TV and you haven't practiced before, you're in for disaster because you're probably not going to be able to do it. So you have to be able, from a mental standpoint, to be able to play shots, know what shots you can play, and play to those shots that are your best. So I think from a mental standpoint there, you know, if you're playing shots you know you can do, it's going to help your mindset as you go along. And you also have to remember, it's just one shot at a time. You know, one shot isn't going to ruin your whole day. You know, John did talk about, you know, out of bounds obviously isn't a great one. But that being said, you know, you might make a couple of long putts down the road that we're going to make up for what you just did. So there's always a chance to make up for those things. So don't put so much pressure on this shot because, you know, it's just one at a time. And as long as you're focused on what you know you can do based on the setup of the shot that you have, I think it'll ease you into, you know, staying a little bit less chaotic when you're trying to play from a mental standpoint and make it a little bit easier for you, you know, as you're on the golf course. But, you know, golf can be tough at times. I mean, you were talking about wind. I hit 2 8-irons the other day on a windy day, and I hit one 167, one 118, both full swings. One was downwind, one was into the wind. You know, so there's some adjustments that have to be made from a mental standpoint. You know, you have to understand that, you know, I normally have these shots that I hit, but today the conditions are different. So I have to understand from a mental standpoint, I'm going to have to do things different because of the conditions. And, you know, that can help you ease into that a little bit as well. I think, you know, you got to stay as positive as you can when you're on the golf course. I always like to default to, you know, just remember where you are. You're outdoors. You're at a beautiful place. It's a great place to see. You know, nothing else is going on. You're just out there, you know, with your friends, hitting a golf ball. You know, help that to ease you into the round and not put so much pressure on yourself. And for the most part, just remember, it is a game. It is a game that we play. A lot of us are very fortunate because the game's been very good to us, and it's allowed us, you know, to make a living as part of it. But it is a game. So, you know, if you don't play for a living, you know, don't put so much pressure on yourself. And if you haven't played shots, that, you know, in conditions, you know, make sure you practice those first. And, you know, don't try those things that you haven't practiced. I mean, that's a big one. I try to tell these kids all the time, you know, if you're out there, you know, trying to score and you're trying to play a shot that you've never done before, the odds are you're probably not going to pull it off, you know. So, you know, you have to look at each situation and understand yourself, understand what your limits are, and, you know, play within your limits. You know, I know for me, you know, John mentioned it before, I rarely start off with a driver because I'm just not ready to hit it yet. So I'm going to ease into the round and control something that's going to help me feel a lot better about my game because I'm controlling the ball. I'm getting it in play. I'm putting it in the fairway. And so it helps ease me into the round as I'm playing. But I think, you know, players do put a lot of pressure on themselves. You don't have to hit perfect shots to win tournaments. You just have to shoot the lowest score, you know. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect all the time. I've seen so many times I've watched a player, you know, top a couple of shots along the ground and then hold something from 140 yards. Still a three. So, you know, it doesn't matter. Not enough room in the scorecard to draw pictures. You just put a number in there. So, you know, don't give up. Keep pressing on. You know, we're all going to hit bad shots. It just happens. You know, we all hit shots that, mm-hmm. you know, we don't like, that, you know, we were certainly planning on something else and that didn't happen. But I do like what you guys said, too, from a mental standpoint is, you know, control what you can control. Conditions you can't mm-hmm. control. You can play shots to help with those conditions, but, you know, don't let the conditions get you down. Just understand how to play in them and, you know, adapt. I think that's one of the biggest, from a mental standpoint, you can do is adapt your abilities that you can do to the situation in front of you.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, you have to play within your own abilities, as you say, I think is key. And you have to be willing to, you have to get out and have fun. You know, too often we see players and they're just, you can tell they're just not having fun. And I'm not talking about at the professional level. I mean, it's a whole different, you know, game there, but, you know, I see a lot of amateurs coming off and they're, you know, thumping their clubs in the ground and they're just angry because they didn't, you know, score very well. But they don't practice the right things. And I, you know, this is something I think we would all unanimously, agree. And that is you need to keep stats. You need to know, I mean, I don't know how many times, you know, you work with somebody, they have no idea, you know, how many greens they hit. They have no idea, you know, how many fairways they hit, their putting stats, nothing. And then they have no idea really what part of their game needs the most work. They say, well, I don't hit my drives very well, or they're very general. But when you have that statistical information, you can really dial in on specifics. Maybe it's not your entire short game. Maybe there's certain aspects of your short game that are really weak that if you tighten those up a little bit, you know, you'd have a pretty sound short game. So one of the other things I touch on, and I'm not going to get into specifics, but just to give you a general overview, you know, I talk and in the book, I give a number of different course management drills and practice. I talk about, you know, working with a course management coach, somebody helping you. And obviously I'm referring to your swing coach and what have you. But, you know, the benefits of working with somebody and really even go as far as what to expect when taking a lesson. So preparing for tournaments. So there's in this chapter that I touch on a lot of different areas and learning how to adjust a strategy. Even during a tournament, there might be some adjustments that need to be made along the way. So there's a lot of great things dealing with that. I'm very, very excited. I'm looking forward to this book coming out in the next little while. Again, it's called Mastering the Green, A Comprehensive Guide to Golf. I'm going to keep everybody posted here. And once it's officially launched, I will let everybody know. But you guys did a great job really getting into the meat of things tonight on some of the questions asked. So I really appreciate that. And I think it's going to be a great opportunity for people to really get some insight into their golf game, not only here on the program, but once the book becomes available as well. So thank you guys. As always, give you guys a chance to let the folks know how they can reach out if they want to get in touch with you and anything special that you'd like to plug. John, go ahead, and then Pete.
Well, Ted, thanks again for having us on tonight. And Pete, as always, I enjoyed being on with you. Great job tonight. For the listeners out there, you can go to my website. It's deckergolf.com. I've got almost 200 videos on there. Instructional videos from full swing all the way down to short game and course management, and as well as golf fitness. If you want to reach me on social media, You can reach me through Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, or LinkedIn. And my book is Golf Is My Life, Glorifying God Through the Game. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Walmart sites. There's also an Audible version of the book. And I'm continuing to write for Golf Tips Magazine. My feature of Fairways to Heaven there in each episode. And I have a second book, which I'm very excited about, that's going to be coming out this summer. It's called Fairways to Heaven, One Shot at a Time. So it's a lot of my Fairways to Heaven articles that I've written, but also some new content. And in the book is a tribute to Phil Rogers, and I've got 18 PGA professionals. Most of them are PGA professionals who have written a testimonial and just stories about Phil and our time at Grand Cypress and everything. So I'm really excited about that. And if you're looking for a speaker, if you have a charity event or if you have a church event or if you have a golf event at your club and you're looking for a speaker, I'd love to come to your facility and speak, and we can do a clinic if you need to be. But you can just reach out again on deckergolf.com, my website. You can reach out to me on my, through my website, and I'll be glad to come to your community. But thanks again, Ted and Pete. I enjoyed it as always.
Thank you, John, for that. And always a pleasure having you on the Coach's Corner panel. Pete, go ahead. Best way folks can reach out. And if there's anything special you'd like to plug, go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks, Ted. John, always a pleasure being on with you. You know, a great insight tonight. They can reach me at PeteBuchananGolf.com. All of my contact information is out there. And I always say, you know, just send me a note, drop me a line, call me, and let's get a conversation started about your golf game. That's the best way to start off. Just contact me so we can get started and, you know, find out what you want to do. And I've got some things in the works that you'll be hearing about here probably in the next 6 to 8 weeks, a new exciting venture that I'm going to be involved with. Once that's ready to be announced, I'll let everybody know. But, yeah, just be looking for that down the road. And I think this is going to be a concept that's really going to catch on really, really big with not only golf but all kinds of sports. So, again, thanks, Ted. It's always a pleasure being on the show.
I appreciate it. And, Pete, I hope you'll share that news here first. I hope we'll get an exclusive here on Golf Talk Live and Coach's Corner. But I appreciate it. Thank you, guys. Have a great weekend. And we'll see you next time here on the Coach's Corner panel segment of Golf Talk Live. Have a good one, guys.
Got it. All right. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you.
All right. That was John Decker and Pete Buchanan joining me on the Coach's Corner panel segment here on Golf Talk Live. We're going to take a quick commercial break from one of our new sponsors, Victory Gear, talking about the Victory insole. Great product. Here's their promo.
In the world of golf, every swing, every step, and every stance counts. But what if you could enhance your game and reduce pain while keeping your legs fresher? The answer? One simple change to your gear. Introducing Victory's carbon fiber insoles, the revolutionary performance insoles designed specifically to help athletes reach their full potential. Using patented carbon fiber technology, VKs do more than support your feet. They lower the impact on your joints while improving your stability, letting you hit the links more often with less pain. Visit victory.com, that's VKTRY.com, and use code GT20 for 20% off today. This offer is exclusive for listeners of this podcast. Again, that's victory.com, and use code GT20 for 20% off. With Victory's 90-day money-back guarantee, your only risk is that your playing partner has these insoles, and you don't.
All right, welcome back to Golf Talk Live, and I'm excited to have my special guest this evening, Ryan Schneider. He is the PGA Director of Golf at Shangri-La Resort. He's tonight's special guest, and Ryan's journey to golf is an interesting one. Growing up in South Charleston, West Virginia, he was primarily a baseball player and played sports in a highly competitive environment. However, an injury during his second year of college led him to pick up a golf club for the very first time. And the rest, as they say, is history. His passion for golf grew as he focused on his studies and his game, earned both a bachelor's and master's degree in public administration with minors in economics, sociology, and biology. He went on to work as a director of golf operations for Boca Raton Resort and Club before joining the Shangri-La team as their PGA Director of Golf. So please welcome my very special guest to Golf Talk Live, Ryan Schneider. Good evening, Ryan. Welcome.
Hi, how we doing?
I'm doing very well. Welcome to the show. I'm glad you were able to join me this evening. I'm excited to have you here. So, Ryan, let me ask you, I think probably one of the best ways to sort of get the conversation going is I always like to, especially with new guests, just to get an idea. I read out a little bit of kind of how you got into it. You sort of fell into golf as a not really a fallback, but as a result of an injury, and you were playing baseball and other sports. But what was one of the things about golf that you really enjoyed once you sort of picked up that club the first time, and how did it lead to where you are now? Give us just an overview of how you decided from hitting your first golf ball to at some point along the journey, you decided, hey, I might want to somehow be involved in the golf industry. Give us your thoughts here. Hi, Ryan, can you hear me okay? Hi, Ryan. I'm not sure if we're having a technical issue, but...
can you hear me now?
There you are. Yeah, I can hear you now. Sorry.
You got me? Okay.
Yeah, did you hear my question, or do you need me to... Yeah, no problem. Do you need me to repeat the question? Did you hear it okay, or...
Yeah, I got it. I got it. It all started, my father was, blue-collar, pipe fitter, and it all started with baseball. So I played baseball all the way through high school, ended up hurting my knee in a state championship game, and it continued and kind of pestered me all the way through my second year of college. So one of my buddies, one day when I was trying to make a decision whether I should continue to pursue baseball as a designated hitter, I was a second baseman, and he calls me and says, hey, have you ever played golf? I said, no. And he took me out to the golf course. My first round was played with a set of Walmart Knight-branded golf clubs. And we got out on the golf course. I shot 117 the first time I played golf. And he beat me like you don't know what. So it was embarrassing. And the competitive nature took over. And I hit balls for an entire year every day. And I shot 72 a year to the day later and beat him by a stroke. So that's how it all started. I'm super competitive anyway. My father was it's one of the things my dad instilled in me. And like I said, when we spoke before, he worked for Union Carbide for 27 years and then got his first promotion when Dow Chemical took over. And he retired from that industry. So he was a hard worker, blue-collar guy. And, I can still remember him coming home covered in, grease and soot from working all day and then going and throwing me batting practice just about every day at the baseball field trying to make that work. So I think it hurt him more than it hurt me when I got hurt. But he's
right.
A great guy. Love my dad. Love my dad, man.
Yeah, I think, during that time, dads wanted to, those that had picked up the game wanted to certainly pass that knowledge on to their son. And, some might look at it and say, well, dad didn't really want you to beat him, but I think that was probably a prideful time for him when you were able to beat him, especially very quickly, because that just sort of reinforced to him that, hey, this is something that I'm really passionate about. I really love the game. I enjoy playing it when I can. And now my boy has taken it up as well. Obviously, you took it a little bit further. You got into the profession as well as what I have. I want to talk about that transition. When did you first sort of say to yourself, okay, you started playing, I don't know, most people growing up, maybe start very early in golf. You were a little bit later on golf, but you were very athletic. And as you said, baseball was sort of in the forefront. But you obviously adapted to the game very quickly as a result of your being an athlete. When did you decide, or at what point was the deciding factor for you that said, you know what, I think I'd like to somehow be involved in the golf business, and ultimately you went on to become a PGA member. So to insight a little bit, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. When I first started, it was a bit of a challenge, and most baseball players will tell you this. None of us hook the golf ball. We all slice it. The muscle groups are the same for the golf swing and the baseball swing, but every baseball player will come out and tell you, I don't hit hooks, I hit slices. It's what baseball players do.
So like I said, muscle mm-hmm. groups are the same. So the transition, it's kind of like the transition for a hockey player. That's why you have some great golfers that have been hockey players in their, you know, previous ventures. But when I found out it could actually be an option, I was on the golf course one day playing with a buddy of mine, Troy Weeks, and we were over there just messing around, and an assistant job opened up at my father's club, again, little blue-collar country club. He could drive his cart to, you know, down the road 300 yards and go play golf, Canal Country Club. It's owned by the city in South Charleston now. You know, we were standing there having a conversation, and the assistant job had just opened up. And I went to John Stricker, who was the pro at the time at Canal Country Club, and I said, hey, you know, I'm interested in getting into the golf business. And as most people will tell you, you get looked at like you have six heads, and they're like, what are you kidding me? Are you crazy?
Right.
And that's how it started. I got that job and worked there for about a year and a half. And then my career kind of took off. I was in Pennsylvania for a while, and it's an interesting story how I met my wife, and I have my two kids now, and we can get into that because it's a great story also. But I ended up in Pennsylvania, and that's what led to the woman I'm married to now and my better half, and that's how it all started for me.
Share that, a little bit of that story, if you don't mind, since you've already sure. opened it very well. So, yeah, so you went to Pennsylvania, and obviously you met as you say, your better half. So Melissa. Share a little bit about that.
Yeah. Melissa is my beautiful wife. Let's see. She's gonna get me if I don't remember how long we've been married. 16 years so far. But I was working at a little club in Pennsylvania, Tam O'Shanter, Pennsylvania. I worked for John Kearns. We were PGA Merchandiser of the Year for the public sector in 2003. And, you know, working in the shop, and he's my brother-in-law now, but a gentleman by the name of Mac McDuffie was an assistant with me there, and we're sitting there talking in the golf shop one day. It was, you know, we did probably 50,000 rounds there, had a range across the street, sold a ton of golf merchandise, $1 million a year out of this little golf course. It was unbelievable. And we're sitting there talking behind the counter, and he says, hey, you know what? I think you need to meet my sister-in-law. I was like, okay, where'd that come from? He goes, no, I just think you guys need to meet. So I was going back and forth from Naples, Florida, to Pennsylvania. So I would work golf season in the summertime in Pennsylvania and then go south for the winter. Well, I'd done that for a couple of years. And he says, hey, you need to meet my sister-in-law. So go to Tampa. She'll meet you here. You guys can go out to dinner and everything like that. So I get to Tampa. I never made it to my job in Naples. I ended up staying in Tampa for 4 months. So we started dating and went back to Pennsylvania. And we did this long-distance type relationship. She'd come up and visit and everything like that. And everybody knows long-distance is kind of tough sometimes. So we dated for about two and a half years and ended up, you know, mutually breaking it off and going our separate ways. We both thought, you know, hey, just not going to work out. And out of the blue, one day, I had made it to Florida full-time, left Tam O'Shanter, ended up working at Ken Venturi's club on 951 on the way to Marco, Eagle Creek. And I came in the golf shop one day, and you know, I said, you know what, I'm going to call Melissa. I hadn't talked to her in about 2 years. And gave her a call and asked her to go to dinner and talk about a few things, and we've been together ever since. And it's amazing to think wow. that I have my two daughters, my two beautiful daughters, Carlin and Avery, from that phone call. If I don't make that phone call, my family's probably not where it is today. It's pretty, it's pretty crazy how stuff works out sometimes.
Well, it's a good thing that you made that phone call. You're exactly right. You know, it's always
Absolutely.
Interesting. I always enjoy hearing a little bit of the backstory on you know, with some of my guests, you know, when they come on the show. Is it's always interesting how people kind of get to where they are in life. And, you know, this, as I'm sure you can appreciate, you know, golf is a tough job. I mean, you know, it's not just a matter of learning how to play the game. I mean, golf is a very difficult game to learn. Obviously, you had certain advantages by being athletic to begin with. And as you said, many similarities in baseball, hockey, I played both. So I know where you're coming from. So there's a lot of similarities in there. So you know, when you have a little bit of that sort of athletic background, golf comes a little bit easier, not super easy, but it comes a little bit easier. But then, you know, getting into the business and that, you know, then you have to learn, you know, other skills that are going to benefit you. As I mentioned, you've worked at a number of different places. I didn't obviously name them all, but you were for a while were at you were the director of golf operations for Boca Raton in Florida as well, and then you ended up
yes.
in Oklahoma where you are now, which is interesting. So how did that come about? How did you get to where you are right now?
Okay, this is another great story. So I was at the Boca Resort. I was there for, I think, 6 years. Ended up opening some franchises, some Stretch Zone franchises. There's a little plug for Stretch Zone there. So had a couple of those stores, ran those for 3 years, got a call from Concert Golf Partners to start at a club that was actually about 800 yards from my front door. So how can you turn that down, right? Mm-hmm. So I went to work for them, ended up running a couple clubs for them, which was Fountains Country Club and Indian Spring Country Club in Boynton Beach. And, you know, it's amazing how the dominoes start to fall into place. So we were in Florida, and we actually went to Florida in 2010. That's when I took the job at the Boca Resort. So once we got down there, everything was fine. Florida was Florida. You know, 7 months of, you know, super busy, high action, and then 5 months where, you know, it's like a Clint Eastwood movie. You have tumbleweeds blowing across the road, sand everywhere,
right.
and you can drive
right.
wherever you want to in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So Florida is not Florida. It was when my kids were going to their charter school and everything like that, it would take, 10 or 12 minutes one way to get them to school. When I left down there, I started at Shangri-La on February 12th. When I left down there in January, it was taking 45 minutes one way to get to school
yeah.
and back. So you would pull up to a stoplight and sit through three lights, and you might not get through on the fourth try. It became really, really, really slow and monotonous. And no offense to anybody in Florida or New York, but it's like a miniature New York now.
Yeah.
Drivers aren't necessarily the greatest. You know, I've seen crazy things down there. People pull up in the far right lane, turn their blinker on to go left and go left.
Yeah.
Make a left-hand turn. So,
right.
That was part of it. We were looking for a change. My mother-in-law, God rest her, passed away first part of January, and that was the main reason why we went down there, you know, 13 years ago now, to get a little mm-hmm. closer to family and everything like that. And she passed away, and it was time to make a move, not only for us but for our kids. My kids are just like most people's kids, man. They're spoiled rotten.
Right.
little bit of entitlement there, but they're pretty good. I mean, my 16-year-old's going to graduate high school this year in May, and very proud of her. They're both accomplished cheerleaders. My youngest one is on basically the top team, the top senior level 6 team in America, the Lady Jags out of Miami for Top Gun, another
mm.
plug.
Mm.
So congratulations to them. But I'm very proud of them. But we made the move, you know, for them. And to just basically get back to what I'm used to. Not that I was a fish out of water in Florida. I like to say I can adapt to any environment, which I've done through my whole career, and I've been successful, you know, everywhere I've been. But this is actually, you know, what we were looking for. It's more of a rural type environment, which is like West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm from. That's what we do.
Right.
And it'll be just a little slower, a little more laid back, a little more relaxed, and my kids get to see what normal, good-natured people with great values are. Not that Florida is not; it's just different.
Right. Yeah, it has. It's become a melting pot for a lot of different areas for different reasons. And I agree. I live in Northwest Florida, so trust me, I know. And it's not as bad as, you know, getting around to Orlando and that, but I can get out of the state, you know, in a moment's notice. So you've migrated now to Oklahoma and you're working at Shangri-La Resort. And it's an interesting story. I want you maybe just touch a little bit on this. So the owner has really transformed the resort into really the pride of Northeast Oklahoma. And put the lakefront vacation, oasis on the map, as it were. They've invested in, you know, somewhere in around $100 million into the property's accommodations and, developed some upscale sort of leisure amenities since taking it over back in 2010. Just give us a sort of a synopsis of what people might expect when they come to visit Shangri-La as far as the And let's just stick with the sort of the accommodations now. I mean, obviously, that's a pretty hefty amount of capital to put into something like that. What can people expect? And then we'll get into the golf a little bit, too. But what can people expect, when coming to stay in that facility?
Well, I mean, it's number one, I've been around the block, right? I've been at, the highest service level Hilton with the Boca Resort. I've been at municipal facilities, high-end private. Semi-private, just about everything you could possibly dabble in I've touched on in my career. But, the reason, it's funny, the reason why I took the job, I came up here for the interview process, and we got to drive around the golf course, and I'll get into the accommodations and stuff like that. But the real reason why I'm here is, we did a little tour on the golf course, and it was dormant. It was December. It's cold. It's 20 degrees. I'm sure my wife from Tampa is going to love that, but we'll get to it. It was pretty chilly and dormant. And I started noticing on the golf course that, when you get Bermuda and it's dormant, you always have a little bit of weed penetration of some type with some clover or, a couple of sprouts here or there. There was absolutely no weed penetration in the middle of winter on this golf course. That's how good the turf is. It's the best conditioned golf course, and again, I've been at some pretty nice places that I've ever been a part of and probably ever seen. We're definitely one of the top conditioned courses in the state of Oklahoma. We've won, some some nice awards. Battlefield's up for the best new attraction for 2024. That one hasn't come out yet. And what you get a full service lake resort, man. It's special. Eddie Gibbs has, like you said, put a ton of money in. Jason Sheffield is the executive chairman. Barry Willingham is the CEO and president. Those guys have done a tremendous job with that place. Crescent Hotels and Resorts is managing the property right now. That's technically who I work for. And then Lance Funderburk, the general manager, military guy, structured, which is exactly what I like. I like to work in that type of environment. He does a great job with the staff we've put together, or he's put together, and the staff that's there is as good as any staff, that I've ever been a part of. But you get a full-service lake resort. You got hotel accommodations, 119 rooms, 27 holes of championship golf. You got a great par three. I'm not sure if you've been out there to play the Battlefield yet, but if you haven't, bring a ton of golf balls and plan on three or four putting a couple greens, because that place is amazing. And it's just the conditions, man. Beginning of May, the wildflowers will start to bloom, and we'll get some great photos and the emerald green and when the color starts to pop, it's just incredible. You get the marina, you get some water sports, jet skis, some live entertainment every now and then. You got meeting space, a bunch of restaurants, the Anchor, Summit's up at the clubhouse, Eddie's, marina restaurant. You got Doc's Bar and Grill, so there's a bunch of selections there. The food is great. You got the spa, you got a fitness area, you got pickleball, you got tennis. Did I miss anything? I hope not. I hope nobody's going to get me. But it is, there's literally something for everyone at Shangri-La, and it really is an oasis, out there in Northeast Oklahoma.
What's interesting, when you talk about this is what I hear, and obviously the audience does now, is it's not just your typical, golfing destination. You have a lot of other amenities that are available. So obviously, if a couple wants to come and maybe she's not a golfer, there's other things there. A family can come there. They've got, you've got pretty much surrounded by, a lake where you can get out and there's boating and other, water activities not available. So there's a little something for everybody. And, as you mentioned, you've got 119 room resort hotel, indoor pool, outdoor resort pool with the splash pad and tanning, ledge, that sort of thing, luxury spa, full service marina, and just a lot of, distinct dining in the area as well. So there's a lot to do there. And I think that really is important, even though you're really primarily focusing on the golf fan. It's good to know that when people come out there, not only can they play some great championship-style golf, but obviously some world-class instruction, but there's other things for them to do besides just the golf. And I think you touched on a few of them. I want to get you to comment a little bit because I found this really interesting when I was reading through the notes. Courses is the Legends Course, the ninth, and they have the Mickey Mantle Hole, which is uniquely features two separate greens, and which is interesting because it's named after New York Yankees legend Mickey Mantle, and obviously who hosted the Mickey Mantle Golf Classic charity tournament. Was actually at Shangri-La from 1991 until 95 when he passed away. Talk about that. I mean, that's cool right there. Talk a little bit about that.
It is. There's a plaque, but there is some discussion as to what club he hit on that hole. And I have questioned it a couple of times because it's a, you got two greens there. So I want to know, what green and how the ball went in the hole, because it's a daunting task to get it to that second green, but I'm sure Mickey, being Mickey, could absolutely get it there if that's where it was. So we have an island green, and then we have a green that's about 200 yards behind that up the hill. So you can play two different types. Whoever has the honor on that hole gets to pick the green. That's what the rules are. But that's how it started. So they have a nice plaque memorializing Mickey's shot, and it is. It's one of the it's one of the great things and part of the mystique there at the resort. And, like I said, it's a tremendous play. And Eddie Gibbs should be commended for, his monetary contributions as well as some of the other stuff he's done. Rejoice School. I actually live in Claremore. I'm at my house in Claremore now, so I drive an hour to work every day. But Rejoice is right down the road. He's done a tremendous amount with what he's been given and what he's earned, and I know he's very, very well respected for that, and he has a lot of friends in the area because of those things, and he's a great man.
It's interesting, and especially somebody like yourself who grew up playing baseball, that has to kind of hold an extra special place in your heart to see something like that and to have such a legend be associated with the place that you're now working at. I want to ask you about your position as a golf instructor. What do you enjoy most? And obviously you have a much bigger and broader job. You're not just a typical golf instructor. You have much more, I'm sure, responsibilities. But what do you enjoy most about what you do?
The biggest thing for me is being able to go out and help somebody on the range tee and have it really help them, because nobody wants to go out and shoot 66 all the time. I mean, I'm sure we'd all like to shoot 66 all the time, but the object of the game for most people is to go out, have a good day, have a social atmosphere, and enjoy getting the ball around the golf course and knowing within, some target area within the range of where the ball is going to go. That's what they want. They just don't want to be searching for balls all day and stuff like that. So I usually try to work with people on what they have going on that's working for them. And we make little tweaks. I don't try to reinvent the wheel. I always tell people your golf swing is like your fingerprint. Everybody's different. I'm not going to make you Tiger Woods me, I'm 5'7", 235, man. I certainly am not going to be Tiger Woods.
Right.
But it works. So, you know, that's what I try to do. We work with what you got, and we get you to where you can get the ball around the golf course and have a good time, because that's what it's about. There are very few tour players compared to the population of the globe, and most people aren't trying to do that. But the gentlemen, you know, that were on before, those are great guys, and they got a wealth of knowledge, because I took some notes on some of the stuff they were saying about, you know, facing your trouble. When you get trouble on the left side, you face, or you tee up on the left side of the tee. And they made some good comments. And when you guys got into the weather, when I played competitive golf, and I still do, and I probably played, I don't know, 54 holes since I've been up here since February, because there hadn't been a lot of time for me yet. But when I would play in bad weather, I would always tell myself, hey, this eliminates half the field. And it does, because the guys aren't mentally strong enough to handle it. And that's what you guys were getting into on that first segment, which was interesting. I was agreeing with everything they were saying. It was good. Those guys are good stuff. I was worried about being able to compete with them since you got published authors and everything like that going on before me, but I'm doing my best, man.
No, you're doing fantastic. You know, what's interesting and what they were talking about were really excerpts out of a book that I'm about to release called Mastering the Green. And it's as it says in the name, it's a comprehensive guide to golf. And I cover a lot of areas. So we just, you know, I pulled out a few snippets out of a couple of the chapters to have on the Coach's Corner panel. And both John and Pete have been pretty regular over the years coming on the panel discussion. And so, you know, I know that they can handle themselves quite well. And I try not to throw them too many curveballs. You know, I like to just to sort of give it to them straight, but I know that they can handle it. But yeah, they raise some really valid points. And I think really golf has sort of changed in the aspect that, you know, with all of the technology that we've, you know, uncovered and come into, for a lot of years, it was really getting even more challenging for people, and people stopped having fun. And I think the industry, in many ways, it's still going down that course. But I think for the most part, instructors like yourself and the guys that were on before, recognizing now that people just want to have fun. And they realize they're not going to play on the PGA or the LPGA tour or what have you. They just want to go out and have a good time. And you know, the ladies are the same thing. I mean, you know, the interesting thing now is women's golf has become the fastest growing segment of new golfers is women coming into the sport, you know, over the last year or so, you know, over 800,000 new golfers coming into women's golf. So they're wanting to come out, and, you know, they understand it's challenging. They understand it's hard, but they also want to have fun. You know, they know they got to work. They know they're going to have to put in the effort to get better, but they want to have fun doing it and not feel like they're constantly under, you know, a magnifying glass or pressure. So I think that's important. And that's what we try to do, I think, as golf instructors now is sort of the new thing, is to really get out there and help people to enjoy themselves and obviously improve, but to enjoy themselves. What's the favorite thing that you enjoy, you know, about the resort? Obviously the golf is a big thing in that. What's one of the favorite things that you really want? If people are coming up for the first time to visit Shangri-La, what do you really want them to make sure they don't miss when they're here?
I would say the overall experience. I mean, we have great members, and we did. We spoke a little bit about this in the, you know, the little notes and everything about the way I felt about the people here and, you know, what I've run across since I've been here. So, you know, when I came up here, the first month I was here, I got to talk to a lot of people and, you know, the Ladies Golf Association, and you get to meet them and, or, well, call it what it is, the SLWGA, the Shangri-La Women's Golf Association. I want to make sure I get that right. you know, just the people, you know, the members are great. The customers, the people who are coming in to Shangri-La, just enjoy the people. One of the questions I always ask everybody, you know, when I'm walking around and meeting people and driving around in the cart, because that's what I am. You know, I build relationships with people. That's what we do, right? Golf professionals. That's the main thing. Nobody's looking for let's see, how do I say it? Nobody's looking for professional golfers anymore. They're looking for golf professionals. So they want the business guy that can go out and play 18 and get it around the golf course and teach a little bit and, you know the jack of all trades. But one of the things I asked everybody when I came up there, when I first got up here, was how do you like the area? How do you like Monkey Island, you know, Afton, you know, the area around the resort? And everywhere I've ever been, and this includes my home state of West Virginia, I always get the answer, well, it's great, but there's always a but. And everybody I talk to here has said, man, this is a great place to live. It's a great place to raise your family. That's the only answer I get. I don't get a but, which is amazing to me. You know, I talked to plenty of people. We got 960 members. And they all say the same thing, you know, how great the place is. So, you know, that's put me at ease a lot because it's a you know, big transition for my family and I. But it's, you know, it's one of those things. My wife didn't even know what I was talking about when I was saying it the other day. I was like, man, I can't get a butt here. She's like, what are you talking about? I said, every time I ask somebody, they say how great the place is, and that's it. That's where it stops. It's great. So I fully think we're going to be, you know, very happy here. And the people are great, and it's going to be a good transition for us.
Well, I think it's earned its name very well. I mean, what better name to have, Shangri-La, you know, than to you know, be able to have such a positive, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, all, you know, not to take away from, you know, other places out there, everybody has its uniqueness and every place has a little special something, but it's nice to know that when you go up there, that people have, you know, such a positive outlook of their area. I mean, everybody's a little bit prideful of their home and things like that, but, you know, for people to sort of put a little extra in their step, you know, when they talk about Shangri-La and the surrounding area, that just means that much more and obviously reinforces, you know, that you made a good decision. I want to talk, there's three aspects to the 27 holes. There's the Legends, the Heritage, and Champions. One of the unique things now, and then we'll talk about the Battlefield as well a little bit, but what's really, I think, important is for any resort when it comes to golf, because again, you're getting all different levels of players nowadays. It's not just all the, you know, the low handicap, you're getting high handicap as well. Give us just sort of a quick overview of each of those courses. What's the most challenging and what's sort of a little bit more golfer friendly? I mean, obviously I know they're all golf friendly, but what's sort of the easiest, if you were to rate them of the three, what would be the easiest and what would be the most challenging? And then obviously the other would be falling in the middle somewhere.
Sure. Just from what I've seen so far, I think the Champions 9 probably lends itself to the higher handicapper. It's going to be, you know, less of a time issue and everything like that on the Champion side. I think in order, if I had to put them in order, I would probably say Legends, Heritage, Champions as far as overall difficulty, but we're talking about a shot total. So,
right.
You know, the greens are pretty, you know, they're pretty fast and they get nice and undulated and there's not a whole lot of room to miss it in a bad spot. So you could hit the green and be in a bad spot. And I mean, you could have a 60 footer. And it gets that way on the battlefield. But once we get him rolling, Justin, I'm gonna throw a plug out for my superintendent too. Justin May, my director of agronomy, is an absolute stud. That guy does an amazing job with the golf course. It gets tough to grow grass when you're growing it on rock, and that's basically what we're doing. But he does it, man. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And it's really, really good when it's in peak shape. Legends, Heritage, Champion for me. And then if I'm really wanting to work on my golf game or get ready for a tournament or something like that, I'm going to play the Battlefield because it will penalize you for everything. I know they spoke about playing golf in the wind earlier, and I like to say when you're playing golf in the wind will make you tell the truth in a hurry because a four-yard cut becomes a 30-yard miss in, you know, 25-mile-an-hour wind. And it will make you pay. That little golf course there, I would put that up against certainly anything similar to it. But it's right up there with, you know, the rest of the golf facility as far as condition and everything like that. And if you ever want to give yourself a migraine headache, just go out there and play it from the, you know, the back tee and come and talk to me about 2.5 hours and we'll have a great conversation.
Well, you know what? You have to have some challenge to anything that you do. And it just, I think, puts you in a mindset that, you know what, I'm going to get out there today and I'm going to conquer it. And even if you don't succeed, the fact that you go out there and give it a good try, and obviously, again, can be punishing at times, but at the same time, fun and rewarding. And that's what, again, it goes back to the fun part, is you want to have a good overall experience. So there's nothing wrong with having some challenges on the, you know, the battlefield, as it were, and it's obviously appropriately named. And I think that, you know, wanting to really appeal to a broad range of golfers, you know, as you mentioned, the sort of the pecking order of the other three, you know, I think it's important for a resort to be able to offer a little bit of a variety. I mean, each has their uniqueness, I'm sure, and some are, you know, one is maybe a little more forgiving than others, but at the same time gives you an overall experience and challenge, if you will, unique to each of the courses. And I think that's what people are looking for when they're going to a resort. They want to be able to have that overall experience. Obviously, as you mentioned, there's membership opportunities and obviously some great instruction available as well. Any special events coming up that you want to kind of give a shout out to? Anything that is, as they say, newsworthy that you want to let the folks know that maybe you're planning on making a trip this summer? There's any big events coming up your way that you want to say, hey, you want to come out here and stay here and make sure that you?
Well, we do have a couple in May. I'll cover those. I could sit here all day and go through the entire calendar, but we do have a couple in May. So we have on Cinco de Mayo, May 5th. We have a 4-person scramble going on. It will be the 1-year anniversary on the battlefield course. So if you'd like to play in that, send Bradley Jumper an email, bradley.jumper, J-U-M-P-E-R, at shangrilaok.com. And he will get you registered and signed up. That's going to be a great event for us. But the big one we've got coming up is the Legacy of Liberty. It is a memorial for our service men and women. Eddie Gibbs is, you know, a big historian for World War II, and it will be functioning and opening on May 24th at 10 a.m. I believe we'll have the Smoking Monkey out there. That's our smoker. And I think Barry Willingham is going to give some comments, and it's going to be a big thing, man. They got a they've already got a plane out there. They've got an armored personnel carrier. They've got one with a 30-millimeter cannon on it, a Jeep. We'll have all kinds of memorabilia over there with the stories behind it and everything like that. And we're big proponents of our military veterans in the community, so we're going to keep doing that, and we're going to keep moving forward with things of that nature and supporting the community and the veterans.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Great way to honor the men and women who have served this great nation. We definitely want to find as many ways as possible to thank them for their service. So I think it's fantastic that you guys are doing something like that coming up. You know, you mentioned about a lot of the different activities, the Anchor, which is a 2-year-old, several acre. It's an indoor-outdoor activity park and has a variety of different activities. And also, you have an 11,000 square foot indoor space, which offers some traditional arcade games plus virtual reality games, and then obviously a laser shot shooting simulator, and of course the TrackMan golf simulator. So it's really a great place for family. I mean, it's not just, you know, the adults, but, you know, there's stuff for kids to do there that, you know, maybe are not quite ready to hit the links, as it were. There's lots to do there. So, you know, I just think it's great that there's so many great opportunities to sort of hit the mark for everybody. I was going to ask you too, you mentioned about, you know, your wife, Melissa, earlier, and obviously your two daughters. Do they play golf at all, or do they have any interest in golf?
That's a great question. That is a great question. I've had the golf club in their hands probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 times, and they love Topgolf, but they have absolutely no desire to play golf. They are cheerleaders through and through.
Right.
And for those of us who think that cheerleading is just, you know, rah-rah, kick them in the knee type stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my girls are athletes, man. They are on the travel team, and we used to lead the state, you know, 8 or 9 times out of the state of Florida. They go to Dallas and Houston and Atlanta and all these major cities and compete. And they got one coming up in Orlando on the 27th and 28th. And wish my daughter good luck on that. That's the world's competition, so they're competing against 8 other teams for the best in the entire world, which is going to be amazing if they get it done. They finished, I think, 2nd a couple years ago.
Wow.
But no desire to play golf. I wish they did, man. I wish they did, because I'd be all over it. But you know how that goes. Kids never listen to their dad's coaches. They got to listen to a coach.
Well,
to a coach, right?
Well, I think what potentially will happen at some point, and I know from experience of people that I've known that have had daughters, at some point, if they meet a young man who's really into golf and there's an interest there, you may be surprised. They may decide to take it up at that time. But until then, yeah, you're probably going to be fighting an uphill battle. But it's good that at least you put a golf club in their hand and introduced it to them, and that's more than many out there. You know, that's one of the challenges, I think, that the industry has faced is, unlike many other sports like baseball and football and others, it's not as heavily into the school system. And, you know, for a number of reasons, obviously it's a little bit more costly to you know, play golf than some of the other sports.
Sure.
And I think at some point, you know, with maybe the help of some of the major corporations, you know, as golf gets more and more integrated into society and is more affordable at a more entry level, you know, let's get some more public courses out there, maybe some par 3 courses that are maybe not as challenging. And there's a lot of different innovative things that could happen, but I think you'll see more and more youngsters. And as more women get into the sport, a lot of young girls are getting into sports now that are into golf that were never involved before. So I think as that, you know, grows over time, I think we'll see that. And who knows, maybe your daughters will get more involved at some point down the road as well. And if they don't, that's fine. Any final thoughts
that
you want to share?
Okay,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. They got plenty of other activities to do. Any final thoughts that you want to share about Shangri-La, and then we'll wrap up.
Just, you know, a couple things. For those people who are out there who are listening to this podcast and everything, who've never been there, you know, give the place a call. Call the front desk. I got the phone number right here. It's 918-257-4204. Book yourself a golf package. Bring some buddies out. Play the golf course. Enjoy all the facilities and everything like that. You'd be amazed at how many people actually don't know we're up there in the northeast corner of Oklahoma and Monkey Island. We just had some people from Tulsa that we spoke with the other day had no idea where we were. And I find that hard to believe, because I knew where it was and I was in Florida.
Right.
But come out and experience the property. There's something for everybody. And just to piggyback on what you said earlier, the worst thing a dad can do with kids and a wife at home is to say, honey, I'm leaving for 4 days and going to play golf. Good luck. But
yeah,
you don't have to do that here. You can bring the whole, you can bring the whole family, and then she'll have something to do. The kids have something to do. You can go play 36 holes a day and everybody's taken care of, and we'll do the rest. But it's a great place. And, you know, if you haven't been there, why not try it?
I couldn't agree more. And for those, also, you can, if you want to get more information, you can visit their website. It's shangrilaok.com. And, you can go on there, all kinds of things, including real estate opportunities. If you're looking to you know, get out of where you are and go somewhere different that you've never been before, and a more, as you said, a more relaxed environment than some of the hustle bustle of big cities, this might be the opportunity for you to go. So, again, it's ShangriLaOK.com is the website, and I'm speaking with my very special guest tonight, Ryan Schneider, the PGA Director of Golf at Shangri-La Resort. Ryan, thank you very much for joining me, and I hope you come back and join me again on a future podcast. I appreciate it, and I learned a lot, and I'm going to do my best to try and come out and visit you and check it out. It looks like a fun place to go and get a little golf in there while I'm at it, and I love the water, so that's even that's an added bonus.
Shoot me a text or give me a call, and I'll go out and play some golf with you. Look forward to having you up there, and I appreciate the opportunity to be a guest on the show.
All right, Ryan, you have a great rest of your week, and go have some fun.
Absolutely, Ted. Thank you.
You're very welcome. All right, bye-bye. All right, that was my very special guest this evening, Ryan Schneider, PGA Director of Golf at Shangri-La Resorts. And again, it's ShangriLaOK.com is the website. All of the information is there, all the contact information. Give them a call and plan maybe a little trip up that way in the northeast part of Oklahoma. I've never been to that state, so it would definitely be a new adventure for me as well. All right, I want to thank again my earlier guests on the Coach's Corner panel, John Decker and Pete Buchanan. Thanks, guys, for doing a great job and always bringing your best. And I look forward to another great week of guests next week. Of course, Women of Golf on Tuesday. And then next Thursday, I'll be doing, in addition to the Coach's Corner and my special guest, another travel segment. My good friend Robert Kaufman, my co-host of that segment, is away over in, I believe, Vietnam right now. So he won't be available, but I will pick up the lead, if you will, on that segment. So I hope you'll join us. A lot of good information there as well. On that note, thank you very much again. God bless everybody. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you next time right here on Golf Talk Live.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this week's broadcast of Golf Talk Live. We'd like to thank this week's Coach's Corner panel, and a special thank you to tonight's guest. Remember to join Ted every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. Central on Golf Talk Live. And be sure to follow Ted on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you're interested in being a guest on Golf Talk Live, send Ted an email at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. This has been a production of the iGolf Sports Network.